BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Things Fell Apart. Extraordinary tales from the culture wars. I'm John Ronson, a writer living in America, the land where culture wars begin. And by culture wars, I mean almost everything that people yell at each other about on social media.
We want to take masks off our children. That should be our choice.
You are a white, privileged male who has no experience.
I can't help what I am. I was born like this.
I'm not saying that people should not be allowed to go through that procedure. What I'm saying is it doesn't make them a woman. It happens to be an opinion.
These wars can obsess us. They can consume our lives and tear families apart. I was curious to learn how things fell apart. And so I went back in history to find the origin stories, the pebbles thrown in the pond, creating the ripples. I had no idea what I would find, but I've uncovered some strange and unexpected tales of real consequence. This story is about how, when we get too enmeshed in a culture war, something can change in us. We can lose all reason, and as a result, innocent lives can get destroyed.
There are three detectives, and they said, we're investigating an incident, and your name was mentioned as a possible suspect.
What did you say?
I couldn't even speak. I would never do such a thing.
The crimes Kelly will be accused of are among the oddest you'll ever hear. But before I get to that, let me explain what happened to turn so many Americans so irrational in the 1980s and 90s.
I give you then a great Republican, Patrick J. Buchanan.
In 1992, the conservative commentator Pat Buchanan gave a speech at the Republican convention during which he used an almost entirely unknown phrase. It had been coined only a year earlier by a sociology professor, James Hunter.
My friends, there is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America.
The battlefronts in this great culture war, Pat Buchanan continued, were...
The amoral idea that gay and lesbian couples should have the same standing in law as married men and women. Unrestricted abortion on demand. Radical feminism. Discrimination against religious schools. My friends, we must take back our culture and take back our country.
Later, the conservative thought leader Irving Kristol dismissed this speech as naive, writing, I regret to inform him that the culture wars are over and the left has won. He meant that during the 70s and 80s in America, the left had firmly taken control of education, entertainment and the media. And, as our first episodes have shown, abortion became the law of the land during those years, school textbooks grew more diverse, gay activism was beginning a path to victory, and Hollywood was celebrating those values. So maybe it's no coincidence that in the early 80s, as conservatives were feeling aggrieved that the culture was running away from them, a strange kind of storytelling began to blossom. Bob, I wanted to thank you very much for doing this.
Never could have possibly dreamed I'd be sitting here talking to the BBC today.
It all began with a small number of Christian writers and broadcasters like Bob Larson talking to me from his radio studio in Phoenix, Arizona.
There were very dark themes coming out of music. Some of the death metal bands were deliberately evoking the darkest themes of bloodlust and murder and human sacrifice and all this kind of thing.
And so Bob began broadcasting a radio show where he'd have it out with death metal musicians.
1-800-821-TALK, sitting across from me in the studio, Vincent Crowley and Vincent Breeding. They're members of a satanic death metal band called Asheron. And these guys are not nice.
A culture war was brewing between Christian conservatives like Bob and liberals who felt that musicians should be left alone to be as provocative as they liked.
If a kid listens to your music and gets a demon that goes out and kills somebody, you don't take it
Do you take it your responsibility?
It seemed to me that it was more than just show business. I began to wonder, what's happening here? Is this just unrelated and random, or is there some diabolical scheme?
By diabolical scheme, Bob wasn't talking about shadowy liberals running the entertainment industry. He meant a scheme plotted in hell itself. He began inviting any listener who claimed to have personal experience with Satanism to call into his radio show, which he says they did in their droves.
The killing of babies, being made to eat human flesh.
Bob's listeners were reporting that it went way further than just heavy metal lyrics. In regular streets all over America, secret cabals were ritually abusing children in the name of Satan. They told stories of cannibalism and dead cats nailed to pulpits.
I was just, in my mind, reporting, and I was after the devil. I saw myself as someone who has a deep responsibility to warn people that the power of Satan is real, that he does do unspeakable, diabolical things.
Bob wanted to spread the warning beyond his small community of radio listeners, and so he collected the most horrific of the stories into a novel, Dead Air, about a radio host who rescues children from satanic cults.
It was touted as being based on actual events.
This is John Trott, a journalist with the Christian Cornerstone magazine. Back in the 80s, John investigated the claims that Bob made in his novel.
You basically had an intergenerational satanic cult and the abuse of young women, and I believe children, pulling one of them through the rear end of a dead horse.
Passing people through horses, did you say?
Yeah, the rear end of a dead horse, yeah. It was a satanic birthing ceremony.
So what, they put the woman, was it a woman or a child?
I thought it was a woman, but my mind has thankfully forgotten some of the detail.
I'm just thinking about the logistics. I'm going to say it's more likely to have been a child. We can laugh about these things because they didn't happen. They didn't occur. This is
correct.
Correct.
And that even is one of the things that irritates me more about this. Is that it takes the focus away from actual abuse that's going on and going on high levels.
If all this reminds you of QAnon today, the theory that the Democrats and Hollywood elites derive their power from secretly drinking the blood of kidnapped children, you aren't alone.
I believe that QAnon is a direct parallel. I think they're some of the same people.
We'll brush up against QAnon some more in a later episode. But for now, back to Bob Larson.
It sounds bizarre, but I had numbers of people telling me the same story.
Did you ever see any rebirthing via a horse with your own eyes?
Did I ever witness that happening? No, of course not. I wouldn't be able to. You can't go to a ceremony. You can't be there. Many of the victims would say to me, they would do things deliberately so bizarre. If I ever tried to escape and make these kinds of accusations, I would not be considered credible. And so I said, somebody has to tell this. So I labeled the book Fiction Based on Fact.
This is Larry King live in Washington. We'll be back with Bob Larson, author of the new book Dead Air, and John Trott, a strong critic of that book. Don't go away.
With the publication of Dead Air, Bob had found a place on the national stage. Here he is taking on John Trott live on CNN's flagship Larry King show.
Cannibalism, blood-stained and naked children, sexual abuse of a 9-year-old girl, not the usual fare at Christian bookstores.
It's a novel, but it's based on fact. It details the horrible tragedy of satanic ritual abuse in this country.
If it's based on true factual evidence, we want the evidence.
What do you want me to bring into you? A sacrifice baby and lay it in front of you? What kind of evidence will prove to you this is going on?
Let's include some phone calls. Bob Larson's book is Dead Air. John Trott is assistant editor of...
It's worth remembering that this was the 80s, when 90% of Americans believed in a higher power. And with conflicts like this, mainstream broadcasters saw huge ratings potential, not by debunking the satanic claims, but by entertaining the idea that they might be true.
Whether a Satan exists is a matter of belief, but we are certain that Satanism exists. This is a real-life horror story.
In 1988, Geraldo Rivera's two-hour NBC special got the highest ratings ever known for a TV documentary. Even ABC News' 2020 ran a report on Satanism in your local shopping centre.
Three stores side by side, a bookstore, a music store, a videotape centre. This shopping mall in affluent Westchester County, New York, exemplifies how easy it is for children to get their hands on satanic material.
And the police were taking it seriously, too.
We have kids being killed. We have cattle being killed. We have all types of perversion going on, and it's affecting America.
The satanic panic was no longer exclusive to Christian evangelists like Bob Larson. Fears of real-life Satanist child abductors were sweeping the land, haunting people from all walks of life.
My name is Kelly Michaels. I'm a mother of seven, and I live in Pennsylvania.
It's early in the morning, the only time Kelly can talk freely because her seven children are asleep upstairs. Kelly almost never gives interviews. This is her first in many years. Her story starts in 1985.
I had just got out of college. I would say I had an artistic bent. But I really didn't, at that time, I didn't know where I fit in.
Where were you living?
I lived in an apartment maybe 15, 20 minutes from New York because I wanted eventually to go to New York City. I did want to live there, but I couldn't afford it.
Before it all happened, how aware were you of the satanic panic? Were you aware of all this stuff going on in America?
Pretty much not. I was aware of one article about a case in California, the McMartin case. A case of underground tunnels and kids being abused in some sort of satanic sounding way. It just sounded so bizarre.
Kelly is talking about the McMartin family who ran a daycare in California in the 80s. Children were claiming in court that they had been forced to drink blood in satanic ceremonies and watch witches fly and visit a cemetery where the McMartins dug up coffins and hacked up the bodies and still managed to get them back to daycare in time for pickup. The case was dismissed, but only after a 7-year investigation and a 30-month trial, the longest in American criminal history.
So you were there in New Jersey reading this and thinking, well, this is just nuts.
Yes, it made no sense. This is just too weird and just impossible.
And eventually you got a job working at a daycare center.
Yes, I did. Yes. I was 21, 22 years old. I didn't want to work with children. I didn't want to be a teacher. But it was something that sounded a little bit more appealing than waiting in tables. I took the job. I just thought this is just a stepping stone for my life. This is just a stop along the way in my young life to go forward to the next step.
We Care Daycare was in Maplewood, a nice New Jersey commuter belt suburb.
Almost all college-educated professionals, accountants, a couple of lawyers, business people, very busy lives. I would say they were moderately affluent, well-educated. From what I understand, it's a more of a Democrat or more of a liberal type of area. The daycare was in a church basement. It was just rented out to the daycare, but it was not particularly conservative area at all, nor religious.
After less than a year, Kelly moved on to a better paid job in a different daycare. A few weeks after that, and completely out of the blue, the police turned up at her door.
Immediately, my heart started pounding. Maybe something had happened to my family, because why would the police come this early in the morning to knock on my door? There were three detectives. And they said, we're investigating an incident of child abuse at We Care Daycare. And your name was mentioned as a possible suspect.
What did you say?
I couldn't even speak, John, for a few seconds. It was the most, I just tried to get, I would never do such a thing. I would never hurt a child. And he said, look, we're not arresting you. We want to take you down to ask you some questions.
And so Kelly went with them to the police station.
They laid out that they had received a complaint from a mother that her child had been in a doctor's office and a nurse was taking his temperature rectally. And he said, oh, that's what happened at school. She said, what? My teacher takes my temperature. And that did happen. Temperatures were taken, but not with rectal thermometers. There's no such thing in the school. They had a good cop, bad cop kind of a thing going on. And the good cop said, look, Kel, we can take care of this for you. I'm giving you an offer right now of just saying, yes, I touched a kid inappropriately, and it's all over. It never hits the papers, never goes to trial. Plead insanity, and we'll get you a couple of weeks in a mental institution. And I said, no. At this point, anger kicked in. I did not do this. Then he got really angry and said, your life is going to be ruined. And he walked out.
So now you had bad cop and bad cop.
Yes, that's right. You are badgered and badgered and badgered and badgered.
But eventually the police seemed satisfied by Kelly's answers and they drove her home.
And I really thought it was just the worst day of my life that was over and I would never see those guys again. But I was wrong. And that's when it became from a reasonable, if false, accusation to Bizarreville and beyond. They started interviewing children with anatomical dolls, called in one at a time. They asked them leading questions. Where might Kelly have abused you? You're talking to 3 and 4 imagination. They do have pee-pee poo-poo humor, toilet humor. Make poopy cakes was one of the accusations.
What Kelly means is that one child told the police that she had forced them to eat cakes made from human excrement.
All it needed was one child to say a story about poopy and pee-pee, and then every kid is interrogated about that.
If you're wondering how law enforcement could have succumbed to such over-credulity, a few things were happening in America that help explain it. There had been a spate of real-life, high-profile child abductions, like 6-year-old Adam Walsh, taken from a department store in Florida.
Adam evidently was too good for this world. He was much greater than this world.
And at the same time, brand new daycares were opening all over America, in places where there'd been no need for them before because the mothers stayed at home. No wonder newly working mothers were feeling anxious dropping off their kids. Couple all that with the frequent talk on TV of secret satanic cults infecting America. In nervous minds, life's real horrors and its fantastical ones were blending into one.
It just grew more and more insane. What did she put peanut butter on you? I don't even know how that one began. What does that mean? You all took your clothes off. Oh, yeah. And then where'd you go when you all took your clothes off? The choir room. And then, you know, what kind of games did you play? And it was taken as gospel. Just all this crazy stuff being written down.
And what did they say happened in the choir room?
From what I understand, they said I was playing the piano nude.
What tunes did they say you were playing?
Jingle Bells. What is the kids are just lining up for this abuse? That they're just lining up for their turn to be violently assaulted and then putting their clothes back on and going back down. No one's disheveled. No one's crying. None of the little kids say a word. They just go back and eat their Cheerios and play with their blocks like nothing ever happened.
The allegations piled up. Kelly was accused of licking peanut butter off the children's genitals and making them drink urine and roll naked over kitchen utensils spread across the floor, with all of this going unnoticed by any adult for nearly 150 school days.
It defies logic, but that didn't matter. She did it. We don't know how, we can't explain it, and we don't have to. How do we put this together to get this lady to trial?
It took 2 years. Kelly says the police and their psychologists spent much of that time persuading dubious parents that they'd been too overworked to spot the signs of abuse. Were their children having nightmares? Tantrums? Were they afraid of the dark? Were there certain foods they didn't like anymore, like peanut butter? those were signs of abuse.
That was the huge turn that went from parents to say, I know my child, there's no way this could have happened and I wouldn't have known about it, to, you know, I really was overextended here as a working full-time mom, and maybe I just missed all the signs because I just wasn't paying enough attention.
Can I hazard that maybe the other thing that was going on here was that these are parents dropping their children off at daycare centre, working parents probably feel a little bit guilty about the fact that they're doing that. And then when their children start making these accusations, maybe there's a proclivity to believe them too much because they're feeling guilty about their own, quote unquote, abandonment of their children to the daycare centre.
That is a huge element. I was just too busy working and too exhausted, and I missed them. And you're right, the guilt.
Some parents, horrified by their lack of awareness, grew very militant and pro-prosecution. They'd been asleep, but now they were shocked awake and determined to do better. In the end, Kelly was charged with 235 counts of abuse against 31 of the 51 children at the daycare.
The world is digging this grave for you, miles deep, and you have absolutely no power to stop it. You have to go through it.
It wasn't only Kelly. The McMartin case had set off an avalanche. All over America, daycare staff were being arrested for feeding a child a boiled baby or putting a bomb in a hamster and exploding it in front of the class. And in the midst of this, Kelly's trial began.
There was a movement back then called We Believe the Children, which was exploited by the prosecution. The prosecutor passed out buttons during the trial that literally said, We Believe the Children. And the children, by the time of trial, who abused you? Kelly. What'd she abuse you with? A knife. There was no sense of being traumatized. They were just answering questions like good little boys and girls, getting their story straight, very calmly answering the questions. No emotionally charged testimony, as if having lived through horrific experiences.
In fact, a psychologist for the prosecution told the jurors that the apparent absence of trauma was even more proof that the abuse had taken place. She called them the most traumatized group of children she had ever seen.
The trial lasted almost a year. It was at that time the longest trial and the most expensive trial, except for mob boss trials in New Jersey history. And the trial was so long, in large part, because there wasn't a case. So it really was just beating the jury over the head day after day after day with just emotionally wrought testimony to basically say, I dare you to not believe the children. It would be immoral not to believe the children. It would be wrong.
In August 1988, after 9 months of testimony, the jury reached a verdict.
The irony, John, was that the first charge, which started the whole case, was improper taking of a temperature rectally. I was found not guilty. And as they began to read the verdict, that was the first charge. And I remember my attorneys grabbed my hand. They saw through it. They got it. Oh my God, I'm going to be free. This is like, they get it. And then the guilties began. My mouth was hanging open. I had tears coming down my face. I heard my parents crying behind me. The parents were like, yes, yes. You know, they were sort of like a victory kind of thing, a celebration sort of a thing going on. After the verdict, I was remanded. I was handcuffed. I was taken out of the courtroom.
What was your sentence?
My sentence was 47 years in prison.
Kelly was 26. Being a sex offender, especially against children, meant, of course, that her life in prison would be even more difficult.
I was in the punishment wing of the maximum security part of the prison. So this is where the insane went. This is where people who had got into fights or assaulted jail guards or committed serious infractions in the prison and were punished. So it was a punishment wing. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to shower. I didn't want to get up off that cot because I could not process what had just happened, that I had been convicted of crimes that I not only didn't do, but that never occurred. I couldn't process 47 years in my middle 20s. That was my whole life gone.
But then, 2 years into her sentence, a godsend. The Harper's journalist Dorothy Rabinowitz happened to mention to colleagues that she was suspicious of the case against Kelly. She was startled by their reaction. As she later wrote, "Journalists who prided themselves on their scepticism were outraged by the merest suggestion that the state's charges against Kelly Michaels lacked credibility. It made her even more determined to investigate."
She did research, she wrote an article, she slid under the door of a civil rights attorney in New York City, and he was in his 70s and he had retired. He came out of retirement, came to see me after he'd done some investigation and said, "You are absolutely innocent," and was banging his fist on this metal table. "You're absolutely innocent. I am taking this case." And I said, "I have no money. I don't care. I'm taking this case." I took 5 years. The case was overturned by the Appellate Court of New Jersey, and I was released.
And in the end, you were unambiguously exonerated.
Yes. It wasn't a technicality. It was that the case was predicated on grossly manipulative interviewing by the state.
Kelly says that as far as she knows, no parents have ever tried to reach her to apologise. They just, quote, faded back into life. I wondered what Bob Larson, the radio show host who helped kickstart the satanic panic, made of cases like hers.
Did you worry that maybe some of the stuff that you were talking about on the chat shows may have influenced cops, for instance, to believe the children more than they might otherwise have done?
No, I really didn't feel that way. I mean, I felt like I was a communicator. I didn't have an axe to grind. I was simply letting people tell their story. I was an advocate for raising people's awareness of the devil.
Bob is still fighting Satan today and feels no remorse for his actions. On Twitter, he describes himself as the world's foremost expert on the occult, and he routinely performs exorcisms on his followers.
I've made friends over the years, and when people say, "Oh, so tell me about yourself, where did you go to college?" And I dread this moment when I meet new people. I survived the story, I survived it. But it's still horrible to have to say the words, "I was accused of abusing children." It's always painful, it'll always hurt, it'll always be, I'm getting emotional now as I'm talking about it, because it's unjust, and yet I can't do anything about it. It's woven into my story. It's who I am, and that I lived through it, that I was that person. So I've made many friends over the years, but it's always been the very painful. They sit with their mouth hanging open. What? Because I'm this nice little church lady, you know, I have a bunch of kids, and I at social events, I think, what? You were in prison? And so it never ceases to be very painful.
So the pebble thrown in the pond were these original kind of hucksters like Bob Larson, and you got swallowed up. You were one of the ripples.
That's right, yes.
I mean, it's stunning if it would happen in any community, but this was an upscale New Jersey community of educated, smart people.
Yes, almost all of them were well-educated, upper-middle-class, progressive, intellectual, professional people, but under stress and duress. You can put aside your advanced degrees, whatever you consider yourself to be, a realist, a progressive. You're so down to earth, you could spot a scam a mile away. But under certain conditions...
Under certain conditions, progressives and liberals can also succumb to moral panics.
Yes, and this is the thing, that it's much more easier to bash that caricature of a conservative, backwater Christian, but not highly educated, professional, progressive people. Well, these are the very people that believed it. I will also have to say, the media, that's another peg that's also huge in creating a story. And that's your line of work.
Well, we never met a moral panic that we didn't like.
That's right. That's right. I was shocked. I thought, surely the press will see how the impossibility, the absurdity. Surely the New York Times. No.
Nobody wants to be the naysayer. It's very rare that in the midst of the frenzy, somebody will say, hang on a minute, because the flame is burning too hot and people are afraid, well, if I go against this prevailing narrative, then maybe I'll be turned on. I started this interview thinking that the modern day ripple of this is QAnon, but the other modern day ripple of this, I think, is social media shaming. That when something terrible has apparently happened, nobody questions the narrative.
Yes, we're fighting the good cause. We're fighting the good fight. It's a high moral cause. And you're basically steamrolling over reality. You're steamrolling over people. You're steamrolling over facts, doing enormous destruction. And you look back later and go, what did we do? And we're all vulnerable if we allow that primal part of our brain to set the narrative, and we don't stop and use the better part of our brains to analyze and think and reason, we're done for. There's gonna be more victims.
In the 1970s and 80s in America, the escalators of culture wars tended to be the Christian right reacting to the new diversity of thought sweeping the land. But with the rise of the internet, that was about to change. Next time, I meet the very first person to be publicly shamed because of something they did online. Things Fell Apart was presented by me, John Ronson, and produced by Sarah Shebbia. The music was composed by Phil Channel. The programme was mixed by Bob Nettles. The editor was Philip Sellers. It's a BBC Audio production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
That's the moment it hit me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I'm in a cult.
I used to think to myself, these people are mad, but until I realise that I'm mad as well.
I'm Paris Lees, and this is The Flip Side from BBC Radio 4. In each episode, I tell two stories from opposite sides of the coin and use science to ask questions about elements of the human experience that we sometimes take for granted.
I know that we're genetically related, but in my mind, I don't have the feeling that we are necessarily kin.
My dad said, you know that we love you and I am your father, but...
Subscribe to The Flip Side with me, Paris Lees, on BBC Sounds.